The passage that Matt has chosen this evening is 1 Corinthians 7. So I'm going to read the first 16 verses of 1 Corinthians 7. Then I'll pray and then Matt will come up. And in my Bible, that 1 Corinthians 7, it's headed Principles of Marriage. So hear the word of the Lord. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to the husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except perhaps by agreement for a limited time that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now as a concession, not a command, I say this. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each man has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of the husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Let's just pray for the sermon. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. And we thank you for that you don't leave us things unsaid, but you deal with things, some issues that are very difficult. We ask tonight that you be with us. You let us listen to what it is you would have us hear through Matt. Give Matt the words to say and us the ears to hear. We pray this in Jesus' name for his sake. Amen.
Well, good evening and welcome to church. I had the pleasure of welcoming you, and you had the misfortune of seeing my ugly mug as you walked in through the door. But because of that, it means I know there's a number of visitors here this evening, so we're particularly glad to have you here. Hang around after the service. We're going to have tea and coffee and some food in there. And then if I get round to you, I might even throw a welcome pack onto you. We're spending 2 weeks in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 looking at relationships. Tonight, relationships 101, when in fact this should actually be relationships 102 for reasons that will become apparent in about 17 and a half seconds. 101, we're looking at marriage tonight. It should be on 102 because next week we're looking at pre-marriage. So we're looking at singleness, dating and betrothal if you live in Victorian England or read the ESV, or being engaged, as we say, in Australia. So next week, engagement, singleness and dating, which might be the juicy tidbits. But this evening we're looking at marriage. And I want to begin marriage, as it seems appropriate, to begin by talking about quotation marks. They can be the darndest thing. Quotation marks can, in the wrong hands, be used and abused and lead to much deception. And one of the primary ways in today's culture that quotation marks are abused, they are used when they shouldn't be used. Let me give you some examples from the internets. One, fireworks you can trust, sold here. I wouldn't recommend purchasing those bad boys. In case of emergency, remain calm. You're in an elevator. Actually, to be fair, they're probably right because you can't remain calm in an elevator. This one's my favourite. Oh, no, I thought I deleted that one. This one's okay. Fresh pizza, $3 a slice, fresh. Jesus is coming. I'm not quite sure who the Jesus in that picture is. And this is the nub of the problem. Please do not use staples for posting. Correction, please do not use quotation marks for emphasis. Preach it, brother. That's right. Quotation marks should not be used for emphasis. In fact, there are many problems in today's society. Perhaps one could lead to an overuse of quotation marks. And the church, in its history, has not been immune to the disastrous effects of using quotation marks in the wrong way. In this case, it's not an unnecessary addition of quotation marks. It's a very unhelpful lack of quotation marks. In the verses before us, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1, Paul quotes, "It is good for a man to have sexual relations with a woman." And those quotation marks reflect the fact that Paul, like in chapter 6 we saw last week in the morning, is quoting the Corinthians. In fact, he's probably quoting a letter. And if you've been here we've been in this book for like 12 weeks now, you would have noticed me repeatedly referencing that letter, the church, it's referenced in chapter 1, right to Paul, and this is Paul's response. And so in that letter, someone has said, "It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman." And Paul is responding. So you get that? Quotation marks, that means someone else said it. We get that. Here's the problem. For the last 1,400 years in the church, those quotation marks have been missing. And when you read that passage without quotation marks, it looks very different, doesn't it? Because it looks like Paul is saying it is not good for a man to have sexual relations with a woman. It appears like Paul is anti-sex. And that is what a lot of people who have been Christian have thought for 1,400 years. Someone wiser than me puts it like this. Paul's view of marriage has been widely misunderstood over the centuries. One major cause of this misunderstanding has been a general failure to recognise until relatively modern times that 1b, it is a good thing for a man not to have physical intimacy with a woman or with his wife, does not stem from Paul, but represents a quotation or a maxim used by some in Corinth, perhaps cited from the letter they sent Paul, which is my theory on it. So how has the church missed it for so many years? A lot of years. Well, end of the quote. As we observed in conjunction with 6:12, which you would have observed if you'd read the commentary, the Greek of Paul's day did not use quotation marks, and readers had to judge what passage embodied quotations. And so that means for 1,400 years, people just assumed that was Paul saying it. But modern scholarship is like 1,000% in agreement, and I think the context is very clear from here and elsewhere, that Paul isn't anti-sex, that this is him quoting someone from there. And the way that you can kind of tell is that he follows a formula in the rest of 1 Corinthians, particularly in chapter 8. He quotes them, as he does at the start of chapter 8, and then he responds. And so he's just picking that up here. He's quoting them and then responding. So for a long time, the church kind of had the wrong view of sex. Now that's kind of, I think, been really helpfully corrected over the last kind of few decades, half a century. But I think the rest of the world still thinks that Christians are anti-sex. In fact, I googled yesterday, why do Christians hate sex? Just wondering what response I'd get. I got like a bajillion hits. And almost all of them, I didn't go through the bajillion, I don't have that much time, but all the ones that I came across all agree that Christians have a really negative view of sex and sexuality. And that's very not true, and we're going to look at that tonight and next week. That being said, there was a party in Corinth for which that is a fair statement. They indeed did despise sex. And that's the group that Paul is responding to here. At the very least, they were forbidding it amongst married people, but likely despised it. And now, where do they get this wrong view of sex and sexuality? Well, it actually comes from a wrong view in chapter 6, which we looked at last week in the morning. And in short, this is the wrong view. It's the view that the spirit is good. It's a very Greek view. Spirit is good. Body is bad business. You don't want anything to do with the body. And so you have a very low view of the body. And what this results in chapter 6 is a group of people going, the spirit matters, the body doesn't matter, therefore I can do what I want with my body, it's not going to affect my spirit, and so therefore I'm going to go to the temple prostitutes. That's what's happening in chapter 6. Of course, that's one possible response to a low view of the body, But there's another, which is chapter 7. And that is because the body is sub-spiritual, because it is kind of below soulish and spiritual things, I want to avoid degrading myself by removing myself from any kind of bodily activity and function I can do. And obviously there's some that you can't. But sex is one you can abstain from. So in order to not contaminate their spirit, they would call it, they wouldn't be involved in bodily, fleshly activities like having sex. That's what the group in Corinth were likely saying to Paul. They were saying to the church at that time. And so chapter 7, the first few verses, verse 7 or so, are responding to this false teaching. Now, you will note that on the top of your chapter 7, if you have the kind of pew Bibles, the ESV, you'll see a title, Principles for Marriage. Now, you may or might not know this, but those titles in bold are not kind of divinely inspired. Some bloke thought of them about 30 years ago, or in the ESV, about 50 years ago. And they're often, like, unhelpful or wrong. Well, sometimes are. This one nails it. I'm totally in agreement with this dude who did this in the 50s. This is about the principles of marriage, and there are four principles this evening we're going to look at. Four principles of marriage. Principle number one from the opening verses, marriage is for sex. Paul, never a guy to shy away from dropping a very heavy truth bomb, drops one in verse 2. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Now, to kind of get what Paul's saying here, we have to understand an idiom, the nature of the Greek language. When he says have his own wife or have her own husband, he's not talking about getting one. He's not talking to single people who need to grab a wife or a husband. No, to have is kind of a euphemism to talk about sleeping with. Had your way with someone is kind of what they used to say back in the day. And so this is talking about wives and husbands sleeping with each other. And so this is the truth bomb. He says to the Corinthians, to those holy people in Corinth who don't want to degrade themselves by getting involved with sexual activity with their spouse, he says, this isn't holy. In fact, in 1 Timothy 4, he'll say it's demonic. It isn't holy. In fact, what you're doing is you're driving your partner to commit sexual sin because you're enticing them with a temptation. And this probably isn't Paul thinking in abstract or in theory. This is probably what was happening in the church. You probably had spouses, probably wives, who were saying, I don't want anything to do with sexual activity because that degrades me. And so in response, the husbands, well, they said, no sex at home, then I'll go up to the temple and find a prostitute there. That's probably the connection between chapter 6 and chapter 7, or another one. And Paul responds by going, no, do not deprive each other. He's very realistic about how God has wired us as human beings. We are created ever since Genesis 1 and 2 as sexual creatures. That's why you fear in year 1 to 4 that girls have got cooties, and then year 7 and 8 you start to be interested in girls. I still remember a conversation I had, one of my earliest conversations in year 3 when I was 8 or 9, with my best friend's mum, Lynn, and she said, do I like any girls? And I said, no, girls were just the grossest thing in the universe. I would never, ever like a girl. And she said, well, that'll change. True enough, 11 years into marriage, it's true. It has changed. And that thing happens in year 7, year 8 or whatever, your body changes. And it gets a bit awkward, but it's intended. God has designed us to be compatible, to be complementary with each other. And he's created us to be creatures of desire. So he's created us creatures of desire, and then he's given us marriage, which is the context, the right and proper context in which that desire is to be expressed and fulfilled. And then to come along as people in the Church of Corinth were and to say that having sex is evil, well, that's to contradict God, because God said the two should become one flesh, and that's a good thing. But you see, here's the thing. You're not only just denying the design of marriage, you're designing the meaning, because that two becoming one flesh thing, yes, Paul talks about it being a spiritual reality, but it's never less than a physical reality. Our union, yes, it's symbolised in the marital union, sleeping with another, but it's also consummated and expressed. That's what a marriage is there to do. And if you voluntarily, and we'll get to that voluntarily bit, but if you voluntarily take sex away from a relationship, you are forcing a wedge between you and your partner, and you are asking for all sorts of troubles because you're denying the purpose of marriage, it being for sex. Okay, principle one, marriage is for sex. Principle two, marriage is mutual. Have a look at verses 3 and 4. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Now, conjugal rights, we've probably watched enough US shows where they have conjugal visits to kind of work out what's going on there. It's talking about sleeping with each other. And Paul here is saying to the partner that refuses to have sex with their spouse, you actually have no right to do that. Your body is not your own. You are in marriage to give yourselves one to the other. That is how marriage works. It's mutual. Now, you hear this, I suspect, and go, yeah, that's it. We get that. That's kind of what marriage is all about. But I think we miss what's revolutionary about this here. Let me read a quote from a scholar on it. Last scholar quote, I promise. I don't normally do this many. In the ancient world, sexual intimacy was regarded either in some cases as a duty for the sake of procreation, or in other, that's having babies, or in other cases as a pleasurable experience for men that women provided. Paul appears to be the first writer to suggest that pleasure could be mutual. So far from being anti-sex Christians, Paul was the first person, this guy states, and I think you could probably debate it over a couple of texts, but he seems to be the first or one of the first to ever state that actually sex is a joy for both partners. It's giving one another to each other. It's not just the man's domain. But here's the thing. I wonder, how's that go in our marriages? All of us are not married here, I get that. But for those of us that are married, how is that kind of mutually giving one another to each other going? Because it's very easy for sex to become a weapon, isn't it? Or at least a tool that you use in order to get what you want from your partner. To use it as a reward for good behaviour, or withheld as a threat or punishment. Gregory has been kind to me today, bought me chocolate, and he's been open and emotionally engaged. He will have his reward later tonight. That's often the subtext of films, isn't it? Or he buys her a lavish present with the expectation of what that payment secures that evening. But that's an utterly un-Christian view of marriage, right? That's almost like a transactional, almost like prostitution, isn't it? You pay and then you get your reward in return. That's not how Christian marriage works. It's mutual. It's giving one and another, not a payment for services rendered. So marriage is mutual. Now, of course, there can be medical reasons why that's not possible, or age reasons, which we'll get to later, or distance reasons. That's fine. Paul here is targeting voluntary abstinence. But let me hop on a hobby horse. Like, honestly, it'll take like a minute and a half. I'm very worried when spouses spend half or more of their time apart from each other. I'm not saying it's wrong, and you know it may well be necessary, but if we've learnt anything from the WA FIFO phenomenon, you know, the fly in, fly out, learnt two things. First of all, stakes can jump from $15 to $50 overnight. And two, it puts an enormous strain on families and on relationships between husband and wife, girlfriend and boyfriend. Without that physical intimacy, the oneness in marriage is seriously threatened. Yeah, and so this is where I get to it. It changes a bit the older you get, I think. There will be time, and some of you are there now, where physical intimacy in that way is no longer a thing. And that's God ordained. But to bring that separation of that physical intimacy into your 30s or into your 40s or into your 50s or 60s is a very dangerous thing. Cutting those physical intimacy ties 6 months a year, it's not ideal. So I'd say long term, probably not ideal. But I do understand at the same time for some people it is necessary. Okay, and then Paul offers an exception in verse 5 to this need for physical intimacy. Verse 5. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again. So Paul, after saying all this, Paul says there is a special case. There is a time in which abstinence, abstaining from that union, is a good thing in order to offer your lives to God in prayer in a especially dedicated way. But note, it's limited, right? Limited time, so that you're not then aroused by temptation, so Satan doesn't tempt you. And two, it's mutual. You've got to agree to it together. So even in your abstinence, it's an act of mutuality. And then in verse 6, Paul says that actually it's a concession, not a command. So he's not saying everyone must do this, but he's saying if it's a thing you want to do, you can, but limit it and make sure you've both agreed to it. That's verse 6. Verse 7 and 9, we're skipping. We're skipping them because next week we're going to look at it when we look at singleness, so we will go back there. And now we're going to move to verse 10. So our two principles so far, marriage is for sex. Number 2, marriage is mutual. And number 3, marriage is permanent. Verses 10 and 11. To the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. And we affirm this in our wedding vows, if we've given them or heard them, for richer or poorer, in sickness and health, to death do us part. But in our culture, infested and riddled with divorce, this principle can sound idealistic, even unrealistic, can't it? And it's tempting to read 1 Corinthians and think back to the 50s when kind of no one got divorced and think that is the world that Paul lives in. But it's totally not the world that Paul lived in. In fact, Paul lives in a world like ours. In fact, check this out, and it sounds a bit like Harry Potter. But if you were in certain states in the Greco-Roman, or the Roman world, in the first century, all you had to do was say this. Tua res tibi habeto. Tua res tibi habeto. And that was you divorcing your wife. That's all you did. You said it in, you declared it out loud, like yelling, I'm bankrupt, and thinking it makes you bankrupt. This is yelling, I'm divorced, and it actually makes you divorced. So, the historian Seneca, who was a guy kicking about the same time as Paul, says this. Many women reckon their years by the number of their husbands. They leave home to marry, and they marry in order to divorce. Right? They're as old as they've been married, and they marry in order to divorce. And my sister had a friend at uni, I remember her well. She'd already picked out her first three husbands. Three husbands. Sounds crazy, but that's actually kind of the world that Paul swam in the first century. And in stark contrast to this is the institution of Christian marriage, the joy of Christian marriage, which isn't temporary, it is permanent. And Paul is very clear, and he says, not I, but the Lord there, which means Jesus said it, not that he's disagreeing, Jesus says it. He's confident because Jesus says it. Wives should not separate from their husbands, and husbands should not divorce their wives. And just as Jesus said, Paul's kind of riffing off that, one flesh union, what God has separated, God has joined together, let no man separate. Now, having said this, this is a passage that deals with exceptions, so we're going to get to those exceptions. Now, if you know your Bibles, you know that there is already one exception to this rule, and that is that Jesus in the Gospels teaches that if there's adultery, then one partner can safely and like justifiably leave the other partner and get remarried, and that's fine. Divorce is allowed. But can I just say, I can't help but think, even though it's an exception that the Lord Jesus himself gives, it's a legitimate exception, I don't think it's ideal, as in I still think the best way as a Christian would be to seek reconciliation and forgiveness even after infidelity. But Jesus' teaching recognises that's not always possible. So that's the one exception that most people are aware of that Christians have. But Paul actually gives us a second exception to the kind of permanence of marriage in verse 15. And it comes in the case of a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever. Check out verse 15. But if the unbelieving partner separates, just quickly, the word divorce and separate, we use them as distinct, but for Paul means exactly the same thing. He's not making two different points when he uses those words. But if the unbelieving partner separates or divorces, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. And so what's Paul saying? Paul's saying that if you have an unbelieving partner and they're not happy with living with you now that you are a believer, then you let them go, be at peace with them, don't force them, don't shackle them to your house. And in fact, in such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. Now, it's debated a bit, and I'm only going here because it's relevant, it's debated a bit what it means to not be enslaved. So the Roman Catholic view would be that just means you're free to not live with them, but you're not allowed to get remarried after that point. That would be how the Roman Catholics, and some Protestants like us. I don't think that's what it's saying, for what it's worth. This is my interpretation. I think when he says you're not enslaved, it's similar to the language he uses later in 39 and in chapter 7, 39, and in chapter 7 of Romans, where he talks about when one partner dies, the other person is unbound and free to get married. And so I think what Paul's saying, I might be wrong, but I think he's saying that if you're you become a believer when you're married to an unbeliever and they leave you because of that, I think you are free to remarry. That's not the position of the church. I think it would be a case-by-case basis, but that's how I'm reading the passage. So, two reasons, adultery and this desertion. But it's worth noting that this is a complex, special case. It's a narrow context. And we must be careful not to abuse it, because I have seen it abused before, and it is abused often. To quote, "I'm free to marry because my husband moved out for a few days, therefore he's deserted me, and therefore I have the right to remarry according to Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. Or, my husband is so emotionally distant from me that he has, for all intents and purposes, deserted me, so I am free to remarry." And to those, Paul goes, no, that's not at all what I'm saying. It's a very specific case of a non-believer leaving a believer on account of their faith. That's the context in which you're free to be remarried believer. Having stated that, can I say there are probably some principles that you can kind of draw out here. In those special cases, cases of kind of violent domestic abuse, cases of destructive drug addiction and the like, I think you can probably... you can probably draw a principle out of what Paul's saying here about desertion and probably apply it to that. But you've got to do it cautiously. It's definitely got to be kind of a case-by-case basis. You can't just carte blanche say that's exactly how it works, because this context is very specific. And again, let us not forget that these two cases, adultery and desertion, they are this exception. Let them not cloud the rule. The rule is marriage is permanent. Which brings us to our fourth and closing principle, marriage is holy. So Paul's just said that if you've got a non-Christian and a Christian and they're married, the non-Christian can leave and that's okay, but it's not ideal. And in verse 12 and 13, he gives us the ideal case. "To the rest I say, I not the Lord," that, which is to say, that is, Christ didn't specifically speak about it, but he's still speaking the truth as an apostle. "The rest I say, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him." Paul is actually saying ideal scenario is that the non-Christian is happy to live with the Christian. And it's really interesting to see the reason why he says this. You think he could kind of roll back to chapter 6 and use the sacredness of marriage, two becoming one flesh, as an argument. But he does something different. Have a look at 14. "For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her child, because of her husband. Sorry. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy." This is a passage that has perplexed many a person. And can I begin by stating what he's not saying categorically? He's not saying that non-Christian husbands or non-Christian children become de facto default Christian by virtue of them having a spouse or a mother or father who's a Christian. And that's clear because verse 16 says this. "For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife?" Paul's saying it's possible that, Christian, your life and your faith might influence them in such a way that they believe so that you save them. It's possible, but it's not guaranteed. And because it's not guaranteed, we know therefore that 14, he's not saying when he says they're holy that they are Christian. So what does he mean by using a word that normally is applied to Christians? What does it mean to be holy in this way? Well, my guess here is that Paul is reacting against those in the church, probably those ones that are actually pushing for this divorce between Christians and non-Christians. And they're probably pushing for it on the basis of purity. They might say that if I stay with my non-Christian husband, he's not holy, He's unrighteous, and therefore in our union I become defiled, and so too our children, by virtue of his unchristianness, become defiled too. And Paul says, nah, that's not how it works in marriage union. If one partner becomes a Christian while they're both married, that's the context, which if you think about it would happen a lot in the early church, because at that point there's no kind of children growing up Christian. It's mass conversions in early days. So if that happens, if one gets converted and the other doesn't, something quite the opposite of defilement happens. Instead of the believer being infected, quote-unquote, with the unholiness of the unbeliever, rather it is the non-believing spouse that is infected with the holiness of the believing spouse. The children are not defiled by virtue of having a non-Christian dad or mum, but they're cleansed by virtue of having a Christian mum or dad. And so, to push this a bit further, I take it he means that by close association with a believer, that their godly life, that the spouse and the children become, you know, touched by their holiness. Not in such a way to become kind of righteous and holy in a Christian sense, but in a way that they stand apart. And that's, you know, a significant meaning to the word holy is standing apart. In a way that they stand apart from the world around them that don't have Christian mothers or fathers or Christian spouses. And I'm sure we've seen that in our lives. If you've been around church long enough, you'll see people... often it's wives praying for their husbands for decades and decades and decades, loving and serving them, and then finally, through the grace of God, they become a believer through their witness. They have truly, at that point, been made holy through their witness. It's not always the case, sadly, but we do experience it. So that's point four, marriage is holy. Okay, we've packed a lot in. We're at the end now. You've done really well. Let me go over those four principles and just have one comment. Okay, so Paul's four principles on marriage. One, marriage is for sex. That is, it's designed for sexual intimacy, and to deny that is inviting disaster. Two, marriage is mutual. Marriage is for the fulfillment of both partners, sexually and otherwise. Three, marriage is permanent. It is for life, except for the exceptional exceptions. And four, as we've seen, marriage is holy. And to close, for those of us who are married or who aspire to be married or engaged, I pray that we never deny any of those four principles by our actions. I pray that we are sexually open and intimate to our partner, that we give our bodies freely without demand, that we never think of our marriage as a temporary kind of situation, but we go in it for life as Christ commands. And to those of us who are married to non-Christians, may we continue and faithfully demonstrate the beauty of the gospel to our spouses and to our children, that they might be holy and maybe, as Paul hopes in verse 16, that we might win them to Christ.
From the highest of heights to the depths of the sea, creation's revealing your majesty. From the colors of fall to the fragrance of spring, every creature unique in the song that it sings, all exclaiming, indescribable, uncontainable. You place the stars in the sky and you know them by name. You are amazing, God. All powerful, untamable, awestruck we fall to our knees as we humbly proclaim. You are amazing, God. Told every lightning bolt where it should go, all seen heavenly storehouses laden with snow. Who imagined the sun and gives souls to its light, yet conceals it to bring us the coolness of night. indescribable, uncontainable. You place the stars in the sky and you know them by name. You are amazing, God. All powerful, untamable, awestruck we fall to our knees as we humbly proclaim. You are amazing, God. Indescribable, uncontainable, you place the stars in the sky and you know them by name. You are amazing, God. Incomparable, unchangeable, you see the depths of my heart and you love me the same. You are amazing, God.